and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, healthcare and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, and answers to your questions and emails. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, here we are, 2010, as I heard on the radio the other day. I'm going to have to work on getting used to saying that. And it being the first program of the year and I being a doctor, I thought, let's talk about New Year's resolutions. Now, there are lots of resolutions. We're all kind of burnt out after all that food over the holidays. So most of us are resolving to perhaps eat a little bit healthier, at least until Valentine's Day. And that's a good one. But we're not actually going to talk too much about diet, but I am going to talk about exercise in terms of a suggested New Year's resolution, how to get basically the most health bang out of just a few hours per year is exercise. 52 hours per year is doesn't sound like that much, does it? That's the break point, actually, between being at-risk sedentary and not at risk sedentary. So if you were a person who spends 12 hours a day at a desk and then another hour commuting to and from that desk, you're a person who needs to hear this. 20 minutes three times a week of brisk walking or very slow jogging, bicycling at a moderate pace, basically getting your heart rate up to 120, 125 is enough. And this is for people under the age of 60. That's kind of the threshold that we're shooting for, is just get moving. Take a brisk walk three times a week, and you will get most of the incremental health benefit in contrast to being sedentary. So that's not so hard. The next one I want to talk about is flossing. That's a good New Year's resolution, folks. There's a lot of things that happen to your body when there is a source of inflammation. And dental inflammation is very, very common. This can be just the gingivitis that happens when your gums become irritated. But when you have inflammation in your body, your blood becomes stickier, and there is a significant statistical increase in your risk of heart disease, like a myocardial infarction and strokes, which, of course, we all know what those are, but also, you may not have realized, of Alzheimer's disease. This level of inflammation doesn't really have to be that noticeable. So taking good care of your teeth is actually a really good way to take good care of your brain. Another suggestion for New Year's resolution has to do with the bisphenol A that we've been talking about on this program for years now. And I want to suggest as an exercise this year, 2010, that you start using less plastic, that you actually go out of your way to find food that isn't packaged in plastic, or at least the parts that you're going to be eating aren't in direct contact with plastic. This is particularly true of that thin cling wrap stuff, because that actually contains a lot of plasticizers, and these are hormone mimics. I prefer the term hormone mimic to endocrine disruptor, just because endocrine disruptor is, it's a little emotional, and perhaps hormone mimic is a bit more accurate. Regardless of what you call it, there are substances in plastic that can interfere with the normal hormonal signaling in your body, and you really don't want that. So reducing the amount of plastic is a really good idea. And you can do that by simply avoiding foods and beverages that have come in contact with plastic. It's quite an effort, I might add, but I think in the long run, probably the cumulative dose reduction that you achieve by just making a good faith attempt at this is worth the effort. And while we're on the subject of hormone mimics or endocrine disruptors, think about all of those things that you do, and I'm guilty of this myself, where I use a cleaner in my household, and on the back it says that you're supposed to wear gloves And if there's a chance of breathing it, you should wear a mask. And I don't. At least up until this last detoxification conference, I'd have to say I don't. Now I do, because I fully accept that a lot of things can actually absorb through my skin, and I should be wearing gloves when I'm in contact with them, because I really do not want to increase my body burden of all of these new-to-nature molecules. If you work with pesticides, if you spray anything in your garden, if you get out there and spray your dormant fruit trees with sulfur oil, you need to be using the recommended protective gear. So that's the New Year's resolution. Read the back of the package, and if it says wear gloves, wear gloves. If it says use a mask, use a mask. If anything, the United States government is very lenient in terms of what they let corporations do with respect to toxicity. So if it says you need protective clothing, you do. So listen, read the package insert. It's very, very important. And while we're at it, wash your fruits and vegetables. You need to clean off the pesticides, and you need to clean off the fertilizers and the various other chemicals that may get sprayed on them to improve their curbside appeal, so to speak, at the supermarket produce area. So you need to wash your fruits and vegetables. Simple. Be a raccoon, wear protective garments and gloves, particularly masks when you're going to be breathing household cleaners. Floss, reduce your exposure to plastic in direct contact with food, and exercise 52 hours a year. Come on, you can do these things, and you'll have a healthier, happier new year if you do. Let's go to Bonnie in Plattsburgh.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I'm a longtime listener, and I'm so happy to finally get a chance to talk with you. I've had two back surgeries for herniated discs. One was 12 years ago, and that was successful. And the other one was 7 years ago, and that left me with a lot of numbness in my buttock, thigh, leg, and foot.
One-sided?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Left leg. Some of the numbness did go away after the surgery, but a lot of it never did. And now in the last 2 years, it's gotten much worse. So I had an MRI done last January that showed scar tissue around the S1 nerve root. And nerve conduction tests, I've had two of those probably a year apart. They showed worsening over the 2 years. Now the numbness is through all five toes and the ball of my foot. And the neurosurgeon that I went to said that surgery for scar tissue is not very successful. So he was not inclined to operate. But I'm wondering if I should get a second opinion, or whether, you know, I'm really concerned about loss of function. My left leg is considerably smaller from the calf down, well, from in the calf area than my right. You know, I'm concerned about circulation, et cetera. So I've tried acupuncture, epidural injections, cranial sacral therapy, and medical massage, but nothing really seems to have had any effect.
Well, I'm not sure how you could measure the effect, really, per se, because at best, when you've already got scar tissue, what you're trying to get is lack of progression of the scar tissue. Getting scar tissue to reverse is very difficult, whether you try to do it alternatively with acupuncture or surgically. You said the nerve conduction studies show progression. I'm quite concerned about that, and you should be as well, and your concern about persistent, or rather I should say progressive, loss of function is a realistic concern. But your first question I want to come back around to, which was, I get a second opinion. I would say you can, but you need to be aware that you can always find someone willing to operate on you. If you keep looking, you will find somebody who's willing to operate on you. That doesn't necessarily mean that you should get operated on.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am always concerned about operating for scar tissue. Your first doctor is correct. The prognosis isn't great, and you end up making more scar tissue by going in.
Mm-hmm.
You said you'd had epidural steroids. Were those completely unsuccessful?
Completely.
Okay. Can you give me...
Well, the purpose of that was to try to break up the scar tissue. It wasn't for pain, because I really don't have much pain. It's basically the numbness that is, you know, the major concern. And the neurosurgeon that I saw said, you can't hurt the S1 nerve root. Go ahead and do Pilates, do yoga, do whatever you want. The more stretching you do, the better. But there are times when I feel like the numbness gets worse after I do things like that. So, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with doing the things I normally do thinking that maybe I'm making it worse on my own.
Right, maybe by putting traction on the nerve or something like that.
Right.
You're in a difficult situation, so I would advise to be conservative. I think that if you feel that you've done something that makes it worse, like certain kinds of stretching, keep stretching, but the next time you do it, do about 75% as much.
Okay.
And do keep your body moving. I think as far as reversing the numbness, let's drop that as a goal.
Okay.
Let's accept that there's some nerve damage and it's going to be persistent. And what we don't want is we don't want it to be progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so of the things you've told me, the progression over two nerve conduction studies has me concerned. And that could be just the variability between the studies. I'm not sure how reproducible they are, but every study has a fuzz factor. And if the fuzz factor is in a negative direction, you could be saying, oh, it's progressive, when in fact it's stable.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like more than two data points before I come to the conclusion that it's progressive. But moving, stretching, is actually going to be beneficial in terms of preventing further progression.
Okay.
Scar tissue is kind of like cobwebs. It doesn't necessarily form in areas where it's getting a lot of activity and motion. It tends to form in the areas where it isn't getting a lot of motion.
Okay.
So movement and stretching are good for scar tissue. It causes it to, if it prevents it from progressing into the space that you're moving.
Okay.
Okay, so think of it as cobwebs, where and sweeping away the cobwebs. I think that's also a very good image to be using for yourself when you're doing mm-hmm. these exercises.
Okay.
Okay. And
I have been doing a lot of leg exercises and hip exercises, trying to increase, you know, my calf strength again, because it had kind of atrophied, yeah. And I really wasn't aware of it. You know, I guess I assumed that walking was going to take care of it,
well,
and then I find out really doesn't.
Well, it's not that. It's just that you have a certain amount of muscle mass there because the nerve is signaling the muscle, and you don't have as much nerve signal on the left side.
Okay.
So that's called trophic stimulation from the nerve. So that's part of the atrophy right there. And so to overcome the absence of this trophic, T-R-O-P-H-I-C, you have to over-stimulate the muscle.
Okay.
With excessive sorts of things like weight resistance exercises to try to get the bulk back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what...
Yeah, I have been successful to some extent. You know, I guess I just need to work even harder or keep not...
Yeah, and don't
fall
be,
off the wagon.
And don't be afraid that you're going to hurt yourself. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty much, you know, into doing whatever I want to, but I was concerned about that hurting, you know, making it worse. But like you said, I'll just stretch a little less and
work your way up to it.
And work my way up to it. Okay, well, thank you so much for your help. And I have another issue, but I'm going to try the elimination diet first, partially at least, and then I'll call you back if that doesn't work.
Very good, and thank you very much for listening out there in New York.
Well, and actually, a neighbor of mine had sent you an email, and I heard her name and, you know, Plattsburgh on November 28th show, and I was so surprised to hear it, but I was glad that I turned around to you.
Well, there you go.
So all happy right. New Year, and thank you very much.
Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Lori in Aptos. Hello, Lori. Welcome to the
Hi.
Program. Hi.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm excellent in general. However, I like to say if the apocalypse comes as a flood, my flotation device is already installed.
Okay.
So I'm on a bit of a cocktail of things like Lamictal and most recently fluoxetine, Prozac for those out there that don't have to take it. And Abilify has been prescribed, and I took it up to 45 milligrams. I'm now on 5 milligrams over the course of 3 months.
Lori, are we treating bipolar disorder here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Over the course of 3 months, I've gained 35 pounds, and I started out at 115, so it's been very dramatic, and I heard some of your weight loss suggestions. But my blood sugar, although my A1C is fine, there's been considerable concern that I'm at diabetic risk, and my cholesterol went almost off scale, even with 80 milligrams of Prevastatin. I'm wondering if you have any experience with how reversible some of these side effects are at lower dose. I mean, seems like it must have affected the appetite center of my brain.
Well, it affects the appetite center of the brain, and it probably also affects things like how your body fat is distributed, and it probably affects the receptor affinities, in other words, how well your insulin works.
Right, and or leptin.
Yeah, exactly. So there's lots of multiple factors that are interacting here, and we have to take a step back and remember that bipolar disorder, when it's manifesting in all of its glory, is a really dangerous disease. It's actually more frequently fatal than cancer.
And that said, I lost about 9 months of the last 12.
Right.
And had I been getting benefit from the medication, it would mitigate some of my feelings about the side effects.
Precisely. And so, to a certain extent, you know, you're in a, between a rock and a hard place because you have a disease which is in and of itself life-threatening and also very difficult to manage with single agents. Amactyl's is basically
right, it's an anti-epileptic.
It's a seizure drug. And
it's been a good friend.
And Abilify is basically a drug that was designed for as an antipsychotic to treat schizophrenia.
Right, like Seroquel.
Exactly, and has been migrated over to bipolar disorder appropriately enough from the scientific standpoint. But it's also got just a truckload of side effects that contribute to metabolic syndrome. And so you're the weight gain and all the other things you're experiencing. So in terms of reversibility, yes, you can reverse the metabolic syndrome aspects. The weight will come off if you stop the drug. But to a certain extent, if you gain too much weight around the middle, your body will fight to maintain that weight. Or rather, I should say, the visceral fat that you've accumulated will try to survive, just like a corporation. It's now an entity, and it has
a flotation device. Yeah.
It has an interest in maintaining its own survival, and it has ghrelin and leptin and adiponectin and a half dozen other hormones which affect hunger and insulin receptors. And so there is a chance of getting yourself into another sort of loop or phase space, and then you have to really work hard to get out of that. But you can get out of it.
What's your feeling about metformin?
Metformin is a really good drug for raising the insulin sensitivity in the liver. Mm-hmm. And so that helps with the blood sugar issues. It's generally anti-weight gain drug. So I use it a lot in metabolic syndrome. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at this combination here, though. Lamictal, Prozac, Abilify, and metformin. And I'm thinking, okay, we've got four drugs, all fairly sophisticated tasks for detoxification in the liver, and we're going to mix those together and see how the person does. And there was a little thing, I don't know if you were listening to NPR this morning, there's a little thing about personalized medicine.
Yeah.
And he was referring to it in kind of risk for diseases, but where I see personalized medicine as being really useful is in a situation like yours, where I would love to know what your liver enzymes could do and choose your medications according to how well your body's going to be able to break them down.
Specifically? I mean, because I'm having general enzyme, but it would be specific activity?
This would be much more sophisticated than just the liver function testing that we do to look for liver damage.
Would this be something that, for instance, an innovative endocrinologist would get behind?
Probably. I would refer you. I would refer you to a company called Genova. They do detoxification genomic testing. And you might be able, they're genovalabs.com, you might be able to get some basic information about the testing from their website or from calling them and then bring that to your innovative endocrinologist who might be very excited by the possibility.
Okay. And just so I'm clear, the purpose there would be to target what aspects of liver enzymes could be activated to reverse metabolic?
No, it's basically breaking down the drugs so that you don't hurt yourself.
Oh, toxicity help.
Yes.
Okay.
Toxicity help. Good luck. It's a complicated issue.
Okay. Thank you kindly.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our next caller is Peggy in Monterey. Hello, Peggy, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have been fairly healthy. I'm 72 years old, except the last 2 weeks, I've been laid really low by what I assume is a viral infection, and I had a fever for a while. I've had a very persistent cough, and my main symptom is fatigue, and it's been 2 weeks, and I don't seem to be getting better. My doctor, after 10 days, prescribed antibiotics, but they really don't seem to have made a difference.
No, why would they? But it's just people are so impatient. And yeah, I totally...
Well, I think I got scared.
Of course, you do. And you want the security of knowing that if it's a bacteria, you've killed it. And this is, by the way, illogical and makes no sense scientifically. And it's really no better than going out and buying a holy metal and saying a prayer. It may, in fact, be worse than buying a holy metal, because in general, buying a holy metal or, you know, lighting a candle at church doesn't necessarily have adverse side effects. The antibiotic, however, can. Anyway, I'm not really faulting you or your doctor. It's a very standard behavior.
Mm-hmm.
When to worry. Okay, so if you get a fever and you have a generalized illness, maybe some body aches, maybe some respiratory symptomology, you're probably looking at a viral infection. And if the virus settles in your chest, irritate the cough reflex, and the mucous membranes have a reflex that coughs when there's stuff in there. But if the mucous membranes are irritated, then they will cough when there's no stuff in there. And that's the typical dry cough post-viral. And that can last up to 2 months.
Wow.
And the reason that you could justify using antibiotics would be if you thought that perhaps you were looking at a case of pertussis or TWAR pneumonia. But pertussis, which is whooping cough, when you get it as an adult, can cause paroxysms of coughing. So you'll cough literally until you vomit. When I hear that story, I'll give people a macrolide antibiotic such as erythromycin, because I have the suspicion, well, maybe there's mycoplasma, maybe there's one of these atypical bacterial pneumonitises, but viruses can mimic that exactly. And so I'm really not sure. And I always give probiotics now if I'm going to do this to somebody, because I'm more concerned about doing harm with my antibiotics to the internal little rainforest ecosystem you've got down there in the small and large intestine, which turn out to be very important for maintenance of health. So it's like, well, do I really want to hit the area with a Roundup? You know, do you want to put Roundup in the vegetable garden? And yeah, sometimes you have to, but we need to be real selective, and we're not selective. We use it superstitiously as a, well, this will make you feel better kind of thing, because we're pressured by our patients and because we're lazy as doctors and we'd rather get on to the next thing rather than spend the 10 minutes talking someone out of getting antibiotics, you know, and that's a real significant problem. Basically, what I would suggest we do for you is just tincture of time, okay? When you should worry is if you start now bringing up large quantities of colored phlegm, not just first thing in the morning, but all day long.
Uh-huh.
Or if you get a second fever after you've been afebrile for 4 or 5 days. That's a post-viral pneumonia until proven otherwise.
Yeah.
And that's what kills people after the flu.
Yeah.
It's the secondary pneumonias, because you get some unusual organisms like Staph aureus causing pneumonia. And those are very nasty when they get into the lungs. In any event, you may cough for weeks. You may cough for a month. You can use cough syrup. You can try using an asthma inhaler and see if that'll help. But basically, it's kind of a live with it thing.
Uh-huh. And the same with the fatigue. You just...
Yeah.
You
rest. Yeah, I know. You rest. If the fatigue persists more than 30 days, then I would get my thyroid looked at, because sometimes viruses will impact your thyroid functioning. But I would wait 30 days.
Okay.
Because you're not even out of the normal range of fatigue at this point.
Uh-huh.
All right?
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Have a great day. Hello, you're on the air. Is this Diane?
Yeah.
Hi, Diane. Hey. And what can we talk about today?
Yes. You know, in December, early December, I started tracking my thyroid, my temperature, just to be curious about my thyroid level. So I started using the thermometer under my armpit first thing in the morning, and I was finding that my temperature on my right side was always lower than the temperature on my left side. And I was just curious about that and wondered if you had any reason why that might be.
Well, it's interesting. And the one possibility that comes to mind is just the increased blood flow to the left side.
Mm-hmm.
The other thought is, you know, are you sleeping with that side down more so that when you wake up in the morning, because you've been lying on your left side, that side has just disproportionately warmer. But there is an anatomical reason why that might be. And that has to do with the design of the arteries. You your left arm, the brachial artery comes directly off of the aorta. And on the right, the anatomy is a little bit different. The artery is a bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So there tends to be, if you check pulses on people, you'll often find that the pulses on the left arm tend to be just a little bit stronger than the pulses on the right side.
Mm.
So this is a trick, by the way, if you're having trouble checking your pulse, try checking it on the left side. If you're a left-hander, you may automatically go for the right side, and the pulse is stronger in general on the left.
Right.
So that could just be that, you know, a little increased blood flow. You want to be consistent. If you're doing your basal body temperatures, you want to be consistent about it. As far as a temperature below 98 being, or 97 or whatever threshold, it being a indicator for low thyroid, this is a screening test, which is a very, very rough screening test, and it needs to be confirmed. You mm-hmm. need to actually get full thyroid hormones and get a T3 and a T4 and a reverse T3 and look at what the body's doing with the thyroid hormone. A lot of doctors make the mistake of just checking a thyroid-stimulating hormone, which will only pick up really significant problems with the thyroid, not mild problems.
Right, yeah. I have been consistent. I've stuck with my left side just because, you know, that's the easiest one that I can get to in the morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started to take Dulse, you know, just more regularly as a condiment.
Right, that's a seaweed, D-U-L-C-E.
Uh-huh. Right, and, you know, I started doing that about after the first week in December, and it took about a week or so, but after that, my temperature started to go up.
Well, that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Mark in Santa Cruz. Hello, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello, Mark.
I suffer from chronic pain, and they're talking about putting a pain pump in me, and I'm a little bit apprehensive about a device the size of a hockey puck being inserted somewhere near my spine.
You think? Yeah, that does, when you frame it that way, that does sound a little bit like the invasion of the body snatchers or something. Okay, so pain pumps. First of all, let me refer you to an interview we did with Lawrence Perret, P-O-R-E-E. It's in the Ask Dr. Don archives. And there's a section in that interview where we do talk about pain pumps and the pluses and minuses of them.
Okay.
So that'd be a good place to start your research. In general, the concept here is to deliver morphine or some other opiate compound directly into the spinal column to try and hit those opiate receptors there and prevent the pain signal from being transmitted up to the brain. And they are an effective method. The complication rate is high enough that you want to think twice about doing it, certainly not to be done lightly. I believe that the infection rate it's in the single digits, not the double digits, but you know, even 1 or 2% infection is still rather high for something like this. And particularly with an implantable device, you're left with a foreign body in there, which can act as a nidus for bacteria, and so they can become spontaneously infected later on. I don't think that they're a bad method when you've exhausted all the other methods. And I presume, if they're talking pain pump, that you've been through quite a lot of other different modalities before you got to this one.
Well, that's the case.
Okay. Now, if the first thing they suggest is a pain pump, you want to run to find another doctor, because that's just not right. Anything else I can tell you about
that? Other than that, I guess I should do the research.
Yeah, it's a risk-benefit thing, and you know your clinical situation better than I. But do go online and go searching for bad stories with pain pumps or pain pump complications, because you'll definitely find forums out there on the internet with people who have had whatever the worst-case scenario is. They'll have experienced it. That doesn't mean you let that scare you off, but it does mean that you kind of want to hear those stories before you take the plunge yourself.
Okay.
Better the devil you know than the devil you don't.
Exactly.
Good luck to you.
Okay, thank you, doctor.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Chuck in Aptos. Hello, Chuck. Welcome to the program.
Hi. You were talking earlier about plastic storage containers.
Right.
Or food New Year, and plastic.
Right, New Year's resolution time. Uh-huh.
Right. Well, of course, most of our frozen food comes in plastic containers, but on top of that, I often make soup in large batches and then freeze it in small batches for a convenient weeknight meal.
Right.
Typically, I freeze it in a plastic container.
Depends on what kind of plastic.
That's what I was going to ask.
Right. There's actually a resource on the Ask Dr. Don website that will take you to a link where they'll help you decode all of the plastics. And the I believe that's an environmental research group website link. And they have a lot of really good information on that website. But you can link to it from mine. And it'll help you decode, because all plastics have a little symbol on them. And using that symbol, you can figure out whether or not you need to be concerned about the endocrine disruptors. Things like Tupperware do not contain a lot of compounds. They're fairly inert. And as long as the compound is not hot and you're not cooking in it with
right.
the microwave.
Well, typically I'm freezing
it
from the refrigerator.
Right.
And so the stuff is already cold.
Exactly. So it's already cold. There's not going to be a lot of Brownian motion, a lot of molecular activity.
Right.
And once it gets even colder, molecular motion tends to slow down. And so the transmission of things into your liquid as it's frozen is very minimal. So it's when you heat it up, I would turn it over and just dump it out into, say, a steamer or something and not heat it in a microwave.
Oh, right. We don't.
Yeah.
Okay, then. Once it's frozen, it's relatively safe at that point?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Because
so
there's not a lot
that,
of transfer.
That liquid state and the transition.
Heat, yeah. Heat plus plastic, bad.
What did you say?
Heat plus food plus plastic, very bad.
Yes, right. Understood.
Okay. Yeah, another trick, just to make it heat up faster, you could use an ice cube tray for your soup. And then make little soup cubes, and then you have the ability to put those, and you can use a plastic Ziploc bag and put that in the freezer, and you're not going to pick up that much contamination.
What I've done in the past is like, the Glad or Ziploc containers, but like I say, the soup is already chilled when I put it in the container, and then I put it into the freezer.
Right.
And then typically just thaw it on the counter until I can dump it out of.
Right. Right. I don't think that's terrible. I really don't. I think that's fine. You're not going to pick up a huge dose that way. It's all about dose. Your body can deal with a little bit. It's just the more, the merrier. And then you mix that with a little dioxin and throw in some leftover DDT dust that you happen to pick up jogging across the field that used to be farmland in the 1950s. And you're talking about this sort of multiplicitude of influences, any single one of which isn't such a big deal. But when you put them together, there's
right.
definitely potential for problems. So
mm-hmm.
it's prudent to reduce your exposure where possible. You know, can't be a fanatic about it. We have to live on the planet. But reducing your exposure where you can is a good idea. And it sounds like you've got a good plan there as far as healthy eating. So I wouldn't want to discourage you from that.
Good.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let's see. So someone had off the air called in wanting to know how to wash meat, because after all, meat comes wrapped in plastic. And, yeah, you wash it the way you wash it, you know, a little soap, lots of water, rinse well. You can wash the surface of meat, not a problem. And you just need to be sure that you get all the soap rinsed off, or you're in for a real interesting culinary experience. You can use a mild soap. I like to use Dr. Berner's Peppermint Castile soap that you get at health food stores. Because for one thing, the taste, you'll know if you didn't get it all rinsed off. And so that's nice. You can just smell it. And if it still smells like peppermint, needs more rinsing. And you can use a very, very dilute solution. It doesn't need a strong solution. It shouldn't be like super soapy water. But it is important to actually wash off the pesticides. Vegetables have pesticides and also bacteria on them. Hopefully your meat came wrapped in skin and has only just been chopped up in a clean environment and wrapped in that plastic. So the chances of bacterial contamination of meat that would be at a high enough level to hurt you is lower, although it's not impossible. We do run into problems with ground up meat. Obviously, all of the E. coli things that have happened over the years with hamburger represent a challenge, but you're not going to get rid of that out of meat by washing it. So ultimately, the only reason to wash the meat is to remove whatever bits of plastic wrap are still clinging to the surface and haven't been absorbed in, and make sure that you lower your dose that way. I'm more concerned about cheese, by the way, in terms of protein sources wrapped in plastic, because cheese is so oily, and the compounds that are in the plastic wrap are fat-soluble. There is definite migration into cheese, and it's hard to find cheese that isn't wrapped in that thin cling wrap. It really is a struggle there for me, having to buy big bits of cheese or go to a very expensive place where they wrap it in wax paper. So that's one that maybe we can vote with our feet and start demanding that our markets do that, actually wrap cheese in a waxed paper like they do in Europe, which I think is a much healthier solution. On our resource page at AskDrDawn.com, you will find a link by the Environmental Working Group that will help you figure out which plastics in your environment are the ones that you need to be worried about. And I think also, if you do consume canned foods, there is at least one company making canned foods where the cans are lined in BPA-free polymer, and those would be the ones to purchase. As I said, vote with your feet. Vote with your pocketbook. Go and purchase the products that have done their best to remove this substance from the environment and encourage them, because that's what we want to do. We want to vote with our pocketbooks. Let's go to Alyssa in Aptos.
Hello, I wanted to ask about diverticulitis.
Okay. What would you like to ask about it?
What is it and how is it cured or what?
Okay. There are two diverticular diseases. One is diverticulosis, which means that it's a structural problem in the intestine. It's associated with constipation. Some people are just unlucky in their DNA and their gut is really stretchy. But if you're an older person and you remember girdles, you'll remember that when they get old, they kind of pucker, bits of elastic are lost, and you get these puckers. Well, in the intestine, that's sort of what happens. The elastic fibers get stretched out and sprung. Little pockets form in the intestinal wall and push themselves out, and they actually look like little tiny fingers when they develop. When you happen to be in the intestine or looking around for something, you can see them as little holes. But from the outside, they look like little fingers sticking out of the bowel. These are diverticula, and people can have one or they can have hundreds. Once you have them, they can become inflamed. That's when you get diverticulitis. So the osis is just structural. The itis means inflamed. When they become inflamed, they can act like little mini appendixes. They're not as big as the appendix, but they can rupture. They can spill bacteria into the intestine, and they can actually lead to life-threatening complications like sepsis or abscess formation. So they can be very nasty. As a result, we have a kind of take-no-prisoners approach in medicine with diverticulitis, which is to say the minute that a person develops the characteristic abdominal pain and the physical findings of diverticulitis, we give them antibiotics and watch them very carefully for improvement. And if they don't improve, then we scan their belly to make sure that they didn't rupture one of those diverticula. So in your situation, I would say that if you have diverticulosis...
No, I'm calling for a friend.
Your friend would be well advised to work their way up to lots and lots of fiber. Because if you have a very high fiber diet, some of the diverticulosis will actually, over several years' time, go away. Not all of it, you'll probably still have a few, but it will reduce in severity, it will reduce in quantity of diverticula, and it will be much reduced in the chances of getting the diverticulitis. So very high fiber diets are really important for people with diverticulosis. Okay.
Thank you very much
for the call, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Judith in Watsonville. Hello, Judith, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling about oral hygiene, wanting to support your intent in recommending that people floss.
Yes.
And I just want to offer a caution about flossing, or perhaps operating instructions. I used to floss very regularly, and I was told you should get the floss down in between the teeth, and I would usually floss before I brushed, which is the wrong time to floss. I had a doctor who explained to me that, you know, flossing, one of the problems with flossing is that you can actually press the bacteria down into your gum line, then tends to exacerbate the problem.
Mm-hmm.
That doctor actually recommended not flossing at all, but brushing with a little bit of, since I had some gum problems, with a little bit of
baking
hydrogen
soda?
Peroxide,
mm-hmm.
and using an oral irrigator,
mm-hmm.
and using plastic toothpicks to get things out from between the teeth. If people, you know, want to floss, that the best thing to do is to brush the teeth first and be careful not to press the floss too firmly down into the gums, because that can cause problems.
Yeah, I think that I found that I have to use two different types of floss. One very, very thin Kevlar floss for my tight occlusions, and a much heavier, thicker bit of floss for the loose occlusions in order to remove the debris.
Uh-huh.
So there's lots of nuances that different people have to come up with. But essentially, the concept of making sure your gums are healthy and keeping them healthy is where I was going with that recommendation.
Yes. So I just wanted to bring out that some people may not be able to floss, and there's other, you know, oral irrigators. There's a number of other things that, you know, the important thing is good oral hygiene and keeping the bugs out from the gums.
Yes, we're on the same page there. Thank you very much for your call, Judith.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's do a quick email. This one I wanted to be sure we got to this week, as it got bumped last week. And this is Dina in SoCal, who's wondering about stem cell treatment for her daughter, who's in her 30s and has moderate cerebral palsy. So I had done a little bit of research on that, Dina, and I'm sorry to tell you this, but we're definitely not ready for prime time when it comes to stem cell treatment for anything. And cerebral palsy, because it is a disease which affects not just the long tracts in the spinal column, but also the brain itself, is going to be one of the late-to-the-table diseases that we begin to intervene with, I would predict, rather than it being early. So given that we are just now in the infancy here, the people who will probably benefit first are the people with the spinal transections, with the spinal cord crush injuries, or the people who've had an explosion where their spinal cord is disrupted, but the structure is still more or less intact, so you can grow new cells across an existing network of myelin sheaths, tunnels, basically. And if you just get the nerves to grow along there, you can reestablish a connection. That, I think, we will see, certainly by the end of this decade. The others, though, diseases like the one your daughter suffers from, I'm afraid we're just not ready to go there yet, and I would discourage you from being the first on your block to undergo that sort of treatment anyway. There is an old saying, the enemy of good is better, and whatever adaptations that your daughter has made to her circumstances, she might find herself in an even more challenged situation. Wait, is all I can say, and I know it's frustrating and really hard when you read about these things and they make it sound like it's going to be tomorrow, but alas, it's not going to be tomorrow. Let's go to John in Davenport. Hello, John, and welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. I was going to comment on your New Year's resolutions with a couple of things that I like to do. I like to observe, and some of the chemicals that I use in my house, let's say two, Windex and 409.
Okay.
Windex, I spray on ants, they look up and say, do it again. 409, I spray on ants, instantly they're dead. So that lets me know the basic toxicity to at least one species, so I take that into consideration and what else I do. So that's how I experiment around with some of the chemicals that I use in my house. With the plastics, I know I can go to the website, but here's one thing that I did observe on the translucent containers that some waters come in and Odwalla come in. If you leave it in the sun, you can actually taste the plastic.
Right.
So I do not drink out of those kind of containers anymore. So another observational situation. And then the last guy with talking about the meat and cleaning of the meat.
Yes.
I don't tend to use soap. I use really, let's say I've got a steak. I use really hot water for a short period of time, lay it on the counter, sprinkle just a little bit of salt on it, and use the flat blade of a knife to scrape any of the residue off. And then I flip it over and do the same thing again. And so far, I haven't been brought down with internal distress.
Right. To me, there's an open question how much of these hormone disruptors are actually getting across into meat from the plastic, yeah. just because the meat has these things called cell walls, and right. there's just not as much opportunity for migration, I think. And I haven't really seen any data. I'm sure it's out there somewhere, but I haven't looked for it on meat. But I do know about plastic and cheese. That's anything that's fatty is a big yeah. issue. And cooking in the plastic is a big yeah. issue. And that includes leaving the plastic water bottle in your car. That's cooking.
Right, right. So I used to work in a butcher shop as a kid, and just even the flopping of the meat onto the cutting boards and things like that, I take that extra precaution to scrape the meat, like I said.
Yeah.
So I remember the big problem with the spinach that we had here?
Right, yes.
And I think it's quite, well, for lack of a better term, irresponsible not to wash the spinach, even though it has been pre-washed. It's only safety consideration for yourself.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's an old technique that I learned many, many years ago in France, which is you take a lightly woven dish towel, the kind that they use in restaurants that are lint-free, but just a linen dishcloth will work. You wash your spinach or your vegetables, and then you put it in the center of the cloth, and you gather up the four corners. And this is fun, too. This is also why it's good to do. And then you go outside, and you whip it around multiple times. And as you whip it, all the water gets sucked up by the centrifugal force. And it's fun, too. I mean, you just squirt that water around, whip it around over your head a few times. Don't let go of any of the corners, however. And then you've got nice, dry, crisp salad.
Yeah.
Works really well, and it's good for your shoulder range of motion.
Excellent. So I guess the last comment is, you're the one that protects anything going into your mouth. You choose it. You buy it. Be careful when you put it in there. Last comment.
Very Thanks. Good. Thank you, John. Bye-bye. This resonates a little bit with one of our earlier callers who was curious about thyroid functioning. This is from Catherine in Maryland. I was recently diagnosed as hypothyroid after feeling really worn out with brain fog for months. I had a baby almost 3 years ago, and during my pregnancy, I felt great, and my family and friends noticed I seemed like a different person, much more balanced and content. I've also had sleep issues all my life. Could this have been something that I've been undiagnosed with since I was a child? Could pregnancy have changed my hormones in a way that made my levels be where they should be normally? I don't think that my TSH levels have ever been tested. This is something of an epiphany for me. I'm seeing a specialist, and I've been on T4 for a month and T3 for a few days, and with the addition of the T3, I feel so much better. I'm still having sleep issues, and I've heard that taking the medications at night is helpful to the sleep issue. Gee, Catherine, a lot of stuff there. To answer your key question, is there something I could have been undiagnosed with since I was a child? Yes, probably if you've had sleep issues all your life, there is something you've been undiagnosed with. Whether or not we actually have a word for it at this point is an open question. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that there's something about your physiology that causes you to have issues with insomnia. On top of that, you got much better with pregnancy. And there are a couple of things that happen with pregnancy, one of which is that if you have certain autoimmune diseases, the immunological tolerance that's influenced by the fact that you've got a placenta with an entity inside your uterus that is carrying 50% foreign DNA, and your immune system would ordinarily automatically attack that. But there are mechanisms that basically cause immune tolerance. So if you're doing autoimmune attacks on your body, when you get pregnant, they will often stop. So that's an interesting clue. You could just have a brain that's very sensitive to the effects of hormones. And that may be also why you stabilized when your hormones stabilized, which is to say during pregnancy. As far as TSH is concerned, the measurement of TSH is a very rough predictor of severe thyroid disease, but it doesn't necessarily tell you about subtle thyroid abnormalities or subtle endocrinopathies. I know that you're probably feeling much, much better on the T3, and it may be, in fact, that you have low T3 levels and your body doesn't make T3 well, and that's why you're feeling better. But the thing to understand about T3 is that T3 is a stimulant. It's a little bit like an amphetamine or like cocaine. So you can feel better on T3 without it actually being necessary that you be taking it. And in the long run, it won't work for you if that's the situation. but it needs to be done very cautiously. Sounds like you're working with a specialist, and I'm all good with that. The key thing, I think, for you is to not be looking for a single identifiable cause of these multiple things that you describe. I think it's more complicated than that. And the treatment may involve using magnesium or some light herbal things in the evening to try and get your body relaxed so that you can sleep. Melatonin might be useful. That's something I would try at a dose of maybe 1 milligram at bedtime. There are all sorts of sleep hygiene issues that need to be addressed. And as far as feeling better on the T3, I'm glad to hear it. I think that you need to make sure that your TSH does not get over-suppressed and drop below about a level of 0.5. And I think you also need to monitor bone breakdown metabolites. If you stay on a fairly high dose of thyroid, it's useful to check your urine for the breakdown products of bone, which are pyridinium crosslinks and pyridinolinium, and we have that on the website because I can never pronounce those correctly. So you'll find that information on the AskDrDawn.com website. And I hope that's been helpful for you. Time for one last email, this one from John in Watsonville. My granddaughter has sports-induced asthma when she is playing soccer. Is there anything she can do besides relying on her inhaler to strengthen her body to handle air pollutants and or pollen? First of all, I would suggest that you have your daughter's pediatrician, because this is your granddaughter, have the pediatrician check a capital I, lowercase g, capital E, an IgE. If the IgE is greater than 100, then it would be, number one, useful to get her tested for allergies to dust mites and mold, and that can be done by a blood test. And the other would be to put her on probiotics containing high doses of Lactobacillus rhamnosus, which has been shown in multiple clinical studies to reduce atopy in children. So if she has a high IgE, you could use these bacteria to actually downregulate the immune response, and you might be able to improve the asthma without the use of drugs. And I want to emphasize, using probiotics is a really, really benign type of intervention, and I just don't worry about it causing any long-term problems for people. I just don't worry about it. We've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I want to invite you to log in to AskDrDawn.com, ask a question, or just review those archives. Lots of good information on the resource pages as well. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.